Yoav Talmi led the Quebec Symphony Orchestra in the Avenaise by Camille Saint-Saëns. The violin soloist, James Ennis. He was about 24 when that recording was made. He's in his early 30s now, 32 maybe. And he just had a new award to add to his mantle this week. His recording of the Elgar Violin Concerto with Sir Andrew Davis and the Philharmonia Orchestra won a Gramophone Award for Best Concerto Recording. Ennis had the opportunity to play the piece in concert several times with Sir Andrew and the orchestra before they recorded it, and he says that was immensely helpful. He says there are so many recording situations where you don't know each other's names at the beginning of the day and have to start from there. Well, congratulations, Mr. Ennis.
What's up? I'm Lou from Sick of It All, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn 89.3, and we're making waves.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Welcome to the WHFR Forum. Today's special show is entitled Basic Concepts of Music, and we're going to begin with Lesson 1, called Common Ground. This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
This is the first of 12 programs in the series Basic Concepts of Music, funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. Program 1, titled Common Ground, presents the overall goals of the series and introduces you to the members of the faculty team. Your host is Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University. Throughout these programs, you'll hear many styles of music from different centuries and different cultures.
The only thing that may be truly international about music is that everyone makes music. Every culture has music.
With these words from music theorist Robert Yerdingen, we begin this series on the basic concepts of music. I'm Peter Burkholder. Yes, everyone makes music, and most everyone listens to music. Our goal in this series is to help you become a better listener, more informed and better prepared to understand and enjoy the great range of music available to you. Throughout these 12 programs, you'll learn concepts and a vocabulary that you can apply to all music, wherever you may find it. In this program, we'll begin to identify the common ground, the common elements in all types of music. We'll talk about the laws, rules, and strategies of music, and we'll look at why music is important to us, both as a culture and as individual listeners. I'll also introduce the other members of our faculty team. Notice that although Robert Yerdingen said that every culture makes music, he did not say, like we so often hear, that music is a universal language. Why not?
There are many musics that don't travel. There are many people for whom the people across the mountain produce an unintelligible music, or at least a music that they don't like and refuse to recognize as music.
We know that with today's rapid communication and high-tech equipment, geography has become less and less a barrier for common cultural ground. But there are still barriers of other kinds. In a family, for instance, parents may think of their children's music as just noise, while the children may not recognize or understand the music their parents enjoy.
Everybody's always talking about who's on top. Don't cross our path, cause you're gonna get stopped. We ain't gonna give anybody any.
But despite differences of geography, culture, or generation, human beings still share common ground for music. Have you ever heard of any society, any human community on the earth, which didn't have music? Do you know of any other species that does have music like ours? Now, if all human societies have music, and only humans have music, then music is deeply connected with being human. All humans share certain mental capacities relating to music. For instance, human beings can distinguish high from low in pitches, and can tell loud from soft in the strength of a sound. And unlike this song of the humpbacked whale, human melodies are characterized by musical scales. Now here is another member of our faculty team, Professor Paul Hack from the University of Minnesota.
Notice that the song of the whale is a continuously sliding pitch, something like a siren. Humans, when we sing, however, use separate tones in what we call a musical scale. Most human melodies use discrete steps, which make up a scale. Something else that is shared by all humans is that people are able to tell the contour of a melody, that a melody becomes higher, then goes low again. Listen to the contour of this melody from The Carnival of the Animals by Camille Saint-Saëns. It starts high, picks a low note, and runs up the scale. Ending on a note higher than where it started.
Once again, Robert Yerdingen.
The ability to make these discriminations are shared by all people. We've never found a people for whom these are unknowns. One culture may utilize one potential of the human mind in a different way than another, but everybody has these potentials. We can recognize differences whether or not we interpret them with the same meaning as somebody else. These might be the laws of music. If you violate them, you might create a music that no human could understand.
So for humans, concepts like scales and melodic contour are so universal that we could consider them laws of music. Scales and melodies differ from place to place, but they are found everywhere. Then, says Yerdingen, there are rules.
Now, rules are more specific to a particular culture. In the West, for example, we've developed rules of counterpoint. If a novice musician tries to write a fugue in the style of Bach, they won't succeed unless they learn all the rules that Bach internalized. He may not have ever written them down, but they were in his mind in the sense that he wouldn't violate them consciously.
So, if laws are the common elements shared by virtually all kinds of music, rules are shared in common within a particular type of music, such as a fugue. Rules of music are specific to a culture. The rules of making a Bach fugue probably mean nothing to a singer in China performing in the Peking Opera. This is a different tradition with its own set of rules.
Oh,
within each culture, the rules are very specific. I mean, the British drive on the left side of the road. We drive on the right side of the road. Either convention gets you down the road safely, but they're specific to a certain culture. Everyone has to decide to agree. Some people think that the definition of a convention is some arbitrary agreement. But all things aren't possible. No one agrees to drive under the road or above it 5 feet. You can't do it. It isn't possible.
Professor David Myers from Georgia State University is another member of our faculty team. He applies Yerdingen's ideas about cultural rules to one of the basic concepts of music, harmony.
Here's an example of the blues, a musical style shaped largely by a specific series or sequence of three different chords. If the rules about these chords were changed and no one told us, we'd have a hard time identifying the blues, because the musical sounds would be entirely different. In Program 4, we'll talk about how chords function as the foundation of harmony in music. We'll discover how rules and conventions of harmony help influence our musical expectations, and how knowledge of harmony can enhance our musical listening.
So, laws are common to virtually all music, while rules are common to music in a particular culture. But there's a third level of common ground, says Yerdingen, even more specific than laws or than rules. It's strategies. And strategies may be specific to only a particular style or composer or piece. For example, there's a common trick in classical music.
A listener will hear the piece heading toward a conclusion or the end of something, a phrase, and at the very moment when it's supposed to end, single tone that should go left goes right, so to speak. It should be in one place and it's a different place. It's a little trick that a composer plays, and they know that the composer will then give them the same cadence again with the correct ending the second time. This is a strategy. It's not a law. There's nothing that says one has to first make a trick or one has to first set up something and then play with it. It's a strategy that people understand intuitively. We have, you know, as we grow and learn about people, we learn about the things people do, what it is to make a joke within a specific culture, what it is to surprise someone, what it is to create a sense of excitement. So as we move from laws to rules to strategies, we go from things that all humans can do to things that members of a large culture recognize and agree to, and to strategies where we're talking about very sensitive understandings of particular musical styles in particular situations.
Barbara Lundquist, the fourth member of our faculty team, is from the University of Washington at Seattle. She will point out some strategies of style.
Well, I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Well, Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Cause there was a
This is Mary, Don't You Weep, performed by the vocal group Take Six. A musical scale, that is, a particular sequence of pitches, can be heard in this piece. The melody has a distinctive shape or contour. And the performers are creating harmony an aspect of music valued in Western culture. But in addition, we recognize the style of the music. That is, we know this music is from the U.S., that it is from a specific period of time, and that it is a particular type of music. We also know that it is being performed by a specific group that we'll be able to recognize when we hear them again. We know all of this because of the strategies that musicians use that allow us to distinguish personal composition and performance styles within the constraints or musical rules of a specific tradition, period of time, or type of music.
As we start to examine the types and styles of music that are common in our culture, we'll discover that there are certain rules and strategies, certain patterns of melodies, harmonies, and rhythms that can be identified as our culture's music. And that is true of every other culture as well. But what immediately complicates that concept is the fact that our modern listening experiences cross cultures. Even as I record this program, the lambada from Latin America is sweeping across the United States. And by the time you hear this program, newer styles from other parts of the world will also have become a part of our eclectic and multicultural listening experience. Why do we like music from other cultures? Why do we love music at all? Why have people in every place and time loved music? As a composer, Alice Parker has a piece of the answer.
I really do feel that music is the language of emotions. That's exactly what it does transmit. And it transmits them by means of mood. And that it's perfectly possible for the same piece to transmit very, very different levels of mood to different people. Because of our own experiences, when we come to a piece of music, it can feel very different to us.
This is particularly true when we listen to music from other cultures. This music for shakuhachi, or bamboo flute, will have a specific meaning for you if you've lived in Japan or have studied its music. In Japan, Buddhist monks offer Zen prayers by playing on the shakuhachi. Even if you don't know anything about this music or where it comes from, it may still speak to you because it creates a certain mood or atmosphere, or satisfies a certain spiritual need. Social context and aesthetics play important roles in understanding and responding to music. Alice Parker talks about how music communicates differently at different times.
If you hear Rock of Ages at a funeral service, you're going to listen to it very differently from if you're at a revival service. And it's almost always that personal connection. At a funeral service, you listen to everything more openly because your emotions are closer to the service.
Mood and emotion have a lot to do with why we love music, why we seem to need it as we observe ceremonies and important moments in our lives. And we may even find different meaning in the same music on different occasions. Thank you. For Parker, listening to and making music form a kind of triangle based on the composer, the performer, and the listener.
And the thing that we've gotten into in the 20th century that has made it very difficult is specialization. That we have composers who only compose and performers who only perform and listeners who only listen. I think before this in the history of the world, there was probably no such thing as listeners who only listened.
So to complete the triangle, composers and performers need the listeners. So listeners have power. If composers and performers want audiences to attend their concerts and to listen to their music, they must engage their listeners, draw them in, and must be aware of the impact their music has on the listeners.
And do you ever listen intently when someone is leaning forward and has you in eye contact and is telling you something that is enormously important to them? It's courting the listener. And it seems to me that all the great composers of the past, and certainly all of folk music, immediately establishes that bond between the performer and the listener.
When conditions are perfect sometimes, you can feel something like a mystical bond between performer and listener.
Ooh, okay. Ever I get my new house done, sail away, lady, sail away. I get my old one to my son, sail away, lady, sail away. Don't you run, don't you run, don't you run, my daddy, oh, don't you rock, my daddy, oh.
Parker describes her ideal listener.
It's a listener who is giving his whole attention to the music and who is not coming at it with preconceptions about what it should be. He's allowing the sounds that strike his ear to make connections in his brain.
Parker says that when you're really listening and responding to all of the cues that the music is giving you,
so that you're really co-constructing it with the composer, and you are also responding, and in a live performance, the kind of response waves that go back from the audience to the performer really do complete the circle. It's an ideal situation, but we've all been at performances where you're just absolutely lifted off your feet. It doesn't happen on a recording, and it can't happen except where there are real human beings there, and it's that incredible kind of communication that's taking place then that we get this hunger and thirst for, I think, that keeps us going.
Parker is talking about an ideal experience when composer, performer, and listener are joined in a moment of perfect artistic communication, and a lot depends on the attention the listener brings. So you see that it's not just what the composer does or the performer does, but what you do as a listener that can make the experience of music so satisfying. On this program, we've been exploring the common ground of music. We heard about the different levels of common ground, the laws, rules, and strategies for music, and explored how we relate to music as a culture and as individuals. On the next few programs in this series, we'll look at the most basic concepts of rhythm, melody, harmony, and form. And then we'll go on to explore texture, emotion, meaning, and style, and how music combines with words, theater, and dance. You'll hear music drawn from all over the world, and the listening skills you'll be learning can apply to any music from any place. Why approach music this way? You've been listening to music all your life, so you're already a knowledgeable listener. But this series will give you different ways to encounter and experience all the music you hear, whether new or familiar. You may not become an expert on any one kind of music, but you'll learn concepts and a vocabulary basic to all music. And that should help you become the empowered listener.
Chorando se foi, quem um dia só me fez chorar.
Common Ground was written by Dr. Carl Signell and produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn, for the series Basic Concepts of Music. This first of 12 programs introduced the members of the faculty team: Paul Hack of the University of Minnesota, Barbara Lundquist of the University of Washington, David Myers of Georgia State University, and your host, J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University. Guest commentators, Robert Yerdegan, Carleton College, and composer, Alice Parker, project director and script editor, Linda Clauder. This audio print course was developed by the University of Wisconsin Extension through Wisconsin Public Radio, the Independent Study Program, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with funds from the Annenberg CPB Project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications.
And you're listening to Basic Concepts of Music here as an hour of the Forum Show for this week. And lesson two is coming up right after these non-commercial messages.
Close your eyes in Chicago, and you can hear the sound of zebra braying in Africa. Look hard out your window in D.C., and you can see the snow-covered peaks of the Andes. The world is that small. We are that connected. Please visit earthshare.org and learn how the world's leading environmental groups are working together. Earthshare. One environment. One simple way to care for it all. A public service message from Earthshare and the Ad Council.
The Center for Lifelong Learning at Henry Ford Community College offers educational alternatives. Options include upgrading job skills, new career tracks, professional development, continuing education, or personal enrichment. And classes are affordable. Call to register at 313-317-1500. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
WHFR is having a blues concert to benefit our station on Saturday night, September 27th, and we hope that you will be there. The New Place Lounge on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn will be the place to hear live blues music featuring Christy and Jeff Howard. The Paul Miles Band.
I like the way you walk, babe, I like the way you talk. Don't you know you got this man singing, ooh, la, la, la.
And the Front Street Blues Band. Only a $5 donation at the door gets you in, and food and beverages will be available for purchase. 21 and over, please. That's Saturday, September 27th, starting at 9 p.m. at the New Place Lounge on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. Please join us for some great blues music and support WHFR, making waves since 1985.
You're listening to WHFR.FM from Henry Ford Community College, an educational non-commercial radio station. We're making waves, the kind of programming you can't hear very much of anywhere else on your Detroit radio dial. We continue now with Basic Concepts of Music, Lesson 2.
Basic Concepts of Music, an audio print series funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. This program on rhythm features Professor Barbara Lundquist of the University of Washington and Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University.
Everything in the world has rhythm. Every sound appears in a flow of time. Sound of ocean waves, a bouncing ball, machinery, each has a distinctive rhythm.
Et les enfants, maintenant, entrez, entrez, vite, vite, vite. Maintenant, maintenant, maintenant.
Human speech has rhythm.
Pour pleuvoir.
In speech, the meaning and flow of the words determine the rhythm.
In music, especially contemporary popular music, we all recognize how important the rhythmic element is. And even when music has no discernible rhythm pattern, such as in this example, we still have what we call free rhythm, a structure that allows the composer or performer to determine just how long each sound and each silence will last, and when new sounds will be added.
Rhythm has its physiological roots in our heartbeats, breathing, walking, and running. Music, like life, has a heartbeat. That's rhythm. Rhythm keeps music moving. I'm Barbara Lundquist, and I'll be discussing the components and characteristics of rhythm with my colleague, Peter Burkholder.
In their book, The Rhythmic Structure of Music, Grosvenor Cooper and Leonard Meyer write, "To study rhythm is to study all of music. Rhythm both organizes and is itself organized by all the elements which create and shape musical processes." This brings up one of the main points we want to make, that rhythm is an important organizing principle in music, perhaps the most important.
Among other things, rhythm helps musicians to play together. It provides the possibility for temporal cohesion. It's like glue, time glue, which is essential to music making. As an organizing principle, rhythm helps people to stay together in all kinds of music, music of every period and culture. Listen to the way these musicians in Count Basie's band play together in this example.
I think we all have a basic idea of what rhythm is, but let's try to define it more precisely. Can we call rhythm an element of music?
It's more of a complex of elements put together. And when we think about rhythm, most of the time what we think of is durations, sounds and silences and how long they last, and what patterns we hear in them. And we call that rhythm. It seems to me that rhythm only becomes rhythm when a human being is present and that music goes into the human being's mind and becomes part of the physiological reaction of that person to the sound that they're hearing. Because rhythm is the human response to sound, the human patterning that comes as a result of responding to patterns in sound.
And rhythm can't really be said to exist until we get that response. It's like communication isn't just words on a printed page. The communication happens when we read it. And in the same way, music doesn't exist, or rhythm doesn't exist just on the printed page. It has to provoke a response in us. I think we can respond to rhythm physically or in the mind without a physical gesture. Dance is an obvious response in a physical way. But also we can imagine ourselves dancing. We can imagine ourselves tapping our foot.
So, through your external and internal responses to rhythm, you become an essential part of the process of making music.
As we examine the complex of elements that makes up rhythm, we'll start with the smallest units of rhythm, what we might call a micro-rhythmic approach. Let's begin by examining the temporal quality of music, the way it exists in time. I think music is a temporal art in two ways. One is that it exists in time. There's no music that doesn't take time.
In that sense, music's different from other art forms, like painting or sculpture.
A painting is there, and we can perceive it in an instant or spend an hour looking at it. We really have our choice. But music, as we listen to it, determines how the time is going to go. It makes the passage of time work in a particular sort of way.
Music makes the passage of time audible.
The other way is that music measures off time, beats or a pulse, things that go tick, 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 mark off time in a psychological sense.
Music can alter our perception of the passage of time.
Time, when we're listening to music, may pass slowly, or it may seem to pass quickly. And that playing with time, that manipulation of time, is part of what rhythm does in music, and it's part of what makes music the art that has the most interesting things to say about time.
Now, if we're going to understand something about that temporal art and this rhythmic or temporal aspect of music, we need to know something not only about what rhythm is, but also what beat and pulse are. Right there we have confusion, because there's a lot of people who think that beat and pulse are the same. I would like to distinguish between those two and think of beat as an arbitrary division of an indefinite flow of time into small segments. That's beat. Let's listen to a steady beat. Those beats have divided the time that took into equal amounts, into equal sections. And within those sections, then, we could do a lot of music making. So a beat is an arbitrary way of organizing a continuum, which can serve as a framework which makes the development of music events possible. Now, pulse could be the same thing, couldn't it? Listen. Some of us have come to use pulse as meaning that fastest continuum of short, undifferentiated, unmarked, unaccented beats that collect every sound in a piece. For example, in a piece that has many sounds in it, like this one, there are many different levels of activity rhythmically. But if you were to take the fastest little pulse that would collect every one of those sounds, then you would have the pulse which ties that piece together. So pulse, I'm using quite differently from beat.
Now that we know something about beat and pulse, let's look at how those durational factors work to structure time, how rhythm serves as an organizing principle of music.
In our example of beat, each beat was unaccented, undifferentiated. But we can group those beats by accent. I'm going to ask you to clap with me to show how this works. Now what I'd like to have you do is to take those same claps and this time group them into twos by making one of them louder than the other. Here we go. And now, will you try it again, and this time group them into threes? Now you can see clearly that you could group them into any number you wanted, and that as you do that, you divide and structure the time, don't you? When you're grouping by accent, periods of time are being marked off by those accents, and it's into those periods of time that sounds are going to be put by the composer and performer. In other words, grouping by accent is the beginning of a metrical structure in music. Meter is grouping by accent. It's where you take undifferentiated or unaccented spaces of time and you provide accent, which puts them into units of either threes, fours, sixes, nines, whatever the feeling is that you want. And it's that feeling we're exploring, that unit of time that we're exploring in music. Now then, different meters feel different ways. Let me just play a couple for you.
That was a meter in three. That was a meter in four. That was a meter in two. Each of those meters gives you a different feeling. If you were dancing or moving to them, you'd probably move in a different way to each meter. So if this is our beat, and this is our meter, this could be our pulse. And that's how those three fit together. Now, how are meters like these used to structure music? Sometimes a single meter would be used throughout a piece, but at other times, different meters are combined, either at the same time or one after another.
We can have more than one meter playing at once in music. For example, here's a meter of two with a meter of three. Listen to it. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, one, two. Another way of combining meters in music is to play more than one meter in a row. For example, here's a group of twos followed by a group of threes. Listen. See how that worked? Three twos and two threes.
It's like adding.
Let's hear how this additive principle works in a Greek dance, a zabek, in which the rhythmic grouping is two plus two, plus two, plus three. One, two, one, two, one, two, one, two, three. One, two, one, two, one. One, two, three. One, two, two, one, two, one, two, three.
So music often has a strong meter or meters. But music can operate free of meter, too. And sometimes a composer chooses, for expressive reasons, to write music that is in conflict with the organizing metrical principle. For instance, Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring includes a powerful example of accents coming in unexpected places.
So we have a meter that's divided like this. But Stravinsky isn't cooperating, but is throwing the emphasis, the accent, into different places in the music. Da 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 da. So it doesn't fulfill your expectations, does it? It in fact conflicts directly with them. It sustains your expectancy for a while, ta 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 ta, and then it breaks the expectancy, ta da pa da, and that keeps your ears curious. It's that tension between the accent of the meter and the accent of the musical events that builds the interest in the listener. We've already talked a little about how music invites a physical response, how we feel the flow of the music.
And one of the most obvious ways, or one of the most common ways, of responding to music is to dance. Throughout history, there have been rhythms that have been associated with particular dances. And those rhythms, because of the dance types that we've got, can have certain kinds of characters. For instance, the minuet is a dance which was popular in the 18th century and has a very different character from the samba, a Brazilian dance from the 20th century. Here's the rhythm pattern of the minuet. And here's a minuet. Here's the rhythm pattern of the samba. And here's an example of a samba. I think you can hear that the minuet and the samba have very different rhythmic patterns, very different dances with two very different feelings.
Up to this point, we've been talking about the small units of rhythm, beat, pulse, accent, meter, and pattern. These are microrhythmic elements that help to organize and structure music. Let's look now at the bigger picture, how rhythm works in a whole piece of music. In other words, at macro rhythmic elements.
We just finished discussing rhythm in relation to dancing. Earlier, we heard an example from The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, and that's a piece that was originally written as a ballet, that is, as a piece for dancing. This is more than a coincidence, because one of the most important points we can make when examining rhythm from our broader macro-rhythmic perspective is that rhythm is movement.
I hope it's been clear all along that the rhythm has been moving the sound. The rhythm is the movement that's carried the musical ideas. But rhythm as movement is something we probably need to identify and to work on just a little bit more. Probably you've been thinking, too, that pace, speed, what we call tempo, is one of the most obvious ways that music moves. Some music is very fast, some is very slow, and some music changes within the course of itself.
For example, this passage has a very different sense of movement than this one. One of the most obvious differences between those two examples is the tempo, the speed at which the music is played, the rate at which it moves. Like meter, tempo can remain constant throughout a piece of music, or it can change. Listen to how the sense of movement is enhanced when the composer asks for an internal quickening of tempo, what we call an accelerando, which is the Italian word for accelerating, or getting faster.
Or pace or tempo of music, there's also the amount of activity that's going on in the music that causes one to have a sense of movement. For example, sometimes there's very few people playing. It's very spare. It's not much happening. And then instruments or voices are added. And there's much more activity. And you have the feeling that it's going faster, or that there's much more motion, when really all that's happened is just that it's increased the number of things that are going on. The activity's increased. It's almost as if there's an intensity of activity which leads you to think of motion.
One word we can use for the way music sounds at the moment is texture. That is, there can be a texture of not very much happening, a single instrument perhaps, or sustained tones. Alternately, there can be a very dense texture where a great deal is happening very fast. The opening of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony gives us a good example of dramatic, sudden changes in texture, where the opening gesture is very loud, and it's followed immediately by very soft music in the winds. Then we pick up a little more, and the entire orchestra enters again.
Thank you.
alternations of different textures are part of how the music moves along. Loud, intense, driving music can alternate with soft, spare music. And that back and forth can give a feeling of large-scale rhythm to a piece. If you think of the form as the shape of the piece, almost in a visual sense, then you'll have a good idea of what we're talking about here.
Sometimes macrorhythmic structures help us to see form more clearly. Let's take this North Indian rag and hear the difference in the handling of rhythm, which helps us to see the form of the piece. In the first section, there's kind of a free rhythm. You don't hear a pulse or a beat. The sounds are taking the duration they have to take, lasting as long as they have to take, as the performer explores them. Now, in this next section, you'll hear that there's a definite pulse. A definite, measured, unaccented pulse. Listen. Now the first section, which was totally free, was called an alap. This section we just heard is called a jor. Here, there's a pulse. Now listen to what happens in the next section, or jala. Here, the rhythm becomes much more complex because there's activity added. Many embellishments, many outrageous bursts of virtuosity. And later in the piece, when the percussion is added, there's even more activity. Rhythm, a complex of elements that organizes and structures music. Rhythm is the pattern of sounds and silences that becomes rhythm as we experience it. Rhythm is movement. This is a quote about rhythm taken from the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians.
Together with melody and harmony, rhythm is one of the three basic elements of music. But since melody and harmony both contribute to the rhythmic organization of a work, and since neither melody nor harmony can be activated without rhythm, the three must be regarded as inseparably linked processes.
I like this quote because it stresses the link between rhythm, melody, and harmony. One of the hard things about a topic like music is that you need to separate things in order to understand them, but you also need to put them together to make music meaningful as a whole. Rhythm, melody, harmony, form, texture, none of these components exist alone. They are inseparable, and it's only when they're put together that we make music.
This program on rhythm, the second of 12 in the series Basic Concepts of Music, was written by James Tucker and produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn. Studio pianist Vincent Fu. Faculty hosts were Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University and Professor Barbara Lundquist of the University of Washington. Project director Linda Clauder. This audio print course was developed by the University of Wisconsin Extension through Wisconsin Public Radio, the Independent Study Program, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. with funds from the Annenberg CPB project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications.
You've been listening to the WHFR Forum this week, two lessons from the series Basic Concepts of Music. We expect to feature another two episodes of this series on the fourth week of October. And now, our public service announcements, unlike you'll hear on any other radio station. After all, we are WHFR.FM, the station making waves. It's WHFR Dearborn.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Dying forests, they were a tap on the shoulder. We got a finger in our chest from the rising sea level, and a sharp poke in the ribs from recent wildfires in Alaska. Then dying coral reefs and eroding coastlines pushed us hard. The drowned polar bears, that was a shove. Melting permafrost, that was a slap. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution before it's too late. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
Hi, I'm David Twitchell, bringing the cable TV show We Are Not Alone right here to WHFR 89.3 FM. Join us the first Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. when local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. So whether you're a believer, a skeptic, or have ever wondered if we are alone in the universe, I guarantee you will find the conversations fascinating and thought-provoking. That's the first Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. We are not alone, and the evidence is right here on WHFR.
Hello, this is Rosie Thomas, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Have a nice day.
Each Sunday on the station Making Waves, join me, John Bomarito, as I put my spin on the best singer-songwriters, modern folk, and Celtic music on the airwaves, acoustic alternatives. Since the summer of 2002, I've been exposing listeners to some of the finest sounds on the airwaves. You just might hear special live in-studio performances from some of my musical friends.
Hey, folks, this is A.J. Croce.
Hey, this is Brian Vander Ark.
Hey, this is Jonathan Brooks.
Hello, I'm Lorena McKinnon.
Hey there, I'm P.J. Olson.
Tune in this Sunday and find out what you've been missing on 89.3 WHFR.FM.
Mommy, you always take the time and do a lot just to keep me safe. Every day, you make sure I'm tightly buckled in my big girl car seat.
The odds of a child being in a fatal car accident are 1 in 23,000. Unlikely, sure, but it's still worth the precautions. Did you know that the odds of a child being diagnosed with autism are 1 in 166? To learn the signs, go to autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
The Center for Lifelong Learning at Henry Ford Community College offers educational alternatives. Options include upgrading job skills, new career tracks, professional development, continuing education, or personal enrichment. And classes are affordable. Call to register at 313-317-1500. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Good morning. You're listening to Light from the Underground. John Bomarito in for Bill Keith. Started off with music from David Wilcox.
Secret of a happy marriage. Maybe you should write this down. You wanna keep a love.